This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Go over the territory we've covered already. 2 weeks ago, we went through the history of health reform and saw how similar the ACA is to most attempts to reform the U.S. health system, particularly those, ironically, that the Republican Party presidents have proposed and members of the Senate have proposed. Last week, we went through some of the roads not taken, alternative ways of reforming the health system. We had a representative who presented on the single-payer health plan proposals. We had one who presented a now more commonly proposed Republican alternative based on tax credits, and a third by Dr. Hal Luft, the former director of the Institute for Health Policy Studies, which was a hybrid plan. So those were two sessions that brought us to the passage of the ACA. Today we're going to dissect the ACA, and I'm going to give a brief, very brief overview of why we have health insurance and what are some of the common problems in health insurance. Then we'll have two speakers, and I'll introduce them then, and a panel with two physicians and two patients. In the interest of saving time, I'm going to do all of the introductions to begin with. Dr. Janet Kaufman, who's a colleague at the Institute for Health Policy Studies, and she also is appointment in family and community medicine, does a lot of research on health workforce issues, health reform issues. She has a distinguished career that spans women's history, public policy, and a PhD in health services research from UC Berkeley, and she's now an associate professor in the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies. Dr. Alina Selmnikov, did I get the pronunciation?
Close enough.
Is vice president from the Kaiser Family Foundation, where she's the director of women's health policy issues. As you know, the Kaiser Family Foundation is one of the foremost research institutions in the U.S. that does research on the healthcare system and on health reform, on Medicare, on Medicaid. They've done some of the most path-breaking work. And Dr. Selmnikov, got her bachelor's degree from Pennsylvania State University and her PhD from Johns Hopkins. Many people in this room we know have ties to Johns Hopkins over the years. Then the two physician health services researchers who are here, our first is Dr. Janush Yazdani, who's a colleague of mine in the Division of Rheumatology. Dr. Yazdani, who got her bachelor's at Stanford, her MPH at Harvard, her medical degree at UCLA, and then was a resident and fellow here at UCSF before joining the faculty. She's one of the foremost researchers on the impact of quality of care on how patients with rheumatic diseases do. And she is on numerous national committees devoted to quality of care issues in rheumatology. Dr. Erica Lawson is a pediatric rheumatology faculty member and also a health services researcher. She was a graduate of the University of Michigan, medical school at the University of Washington, Washington U, then pediatric training at University of Washington before coming here for rheumatology training. Dr. Lawson does research on the several issues related to people transitioning out of pediatric to adult care. And she has worked with a member of the adult rheumatology faculty to develop transition clinics to deal with some of the issues, and I think she'll discuss some of them later. So I'm going to begin with a very short talk on the nature of health insurance and why, what that's about. If I can forward the slides, we will. There are several perspectives about health insurance. Let's start with the beneficiaries, patients, citizens. Why would they want health insurance? Obviously, it's prevent economic calamity. You know, one big stay in a hospital could be millions of dollars. They also want to make the expenses predictable for themselves, to have reasonably small co-payments, deductibles, co-insurance, and charges for their share of the premium for, so that they don't have large payments each time services are needed. They want health insurance so they can buy health care when they think they need it and not to put off things which should be done at the present. And that's true across the continuum from preventive care at one end of the spectrum, say, through chemotherapy at the other. And why do they want health insurance? Because they believe that it'll buy health. Whether or not that's true is another matter. How about health insurers, health plans? They want insurance because that's their business. They also want to stay in business and therefore to collect more in premiums than they pay out for health care plus their administrative overhead. They too want to make costs predictable, and that's premium costs and the beneficiary cost sharing based on reliable estimates of usage, and I'll talk about that more. They want to minimize health costs so they can have a greater chance of staying in business. And they do this by achieving a good actuarial mix of beneficiaries. They don't want too many people who are old and sick. Under the old system, prior to the Affordable Care Act, the way of doing that was to avoid people with pre-existing conditions and older people. Under the new system, they need to entice more people who are young to offset the older people and get them into the pool of people from whom they collect premiums. They want to lower healthcare utilization. Under the old system, they don't provide all kinds of services. A lot of health insurers didn't cover mental health. Sadly, many didn't cover maternity services, particularly under individual plans, and Dr. Kaufman may talk about that some in her talk. Under both the old and new systems, by new I mean the Affordable Care Act, they use cost sharing and utilization review to keep the utilization down, and so the cost can be more predictable, and hopefully they can generate profit. And lastly, the last thing they do, and this has been more controversial, is they often pay providers less. They selectively contract with certain pharmacies, hospitals, and doctors who are willing to get paid less than some other doctors, pharmacies, and hospitals. And lastly, we talk about it from the perspective of the healthcare providers. They too want to stay in business. They want to collect more than it costs to provide the services. They want to collect more from the health plans, and to do that, they're part of a bargaining with the health plans to negotiate higher rates. They want to reduce uncompensated care because that comes out of their pocket of revenues. They want to sometimes provide a mix of services that's more profitable. This is one of the things that the Affordable Care Act was designed to overcome. And they want to reduce the cost of providing services. So they, too, negotiate with suppliers, including their employees. And it's for all these reasons that for the first time in history, both the American Medical Association, representing most of the doctors in private practice, many of the doctors in private practice in the U.S., and the American Hospital Association were strong advocates for the Affordable Care Act because it promised to reduce the amount of uncompensated care, which had become an untenable problem. So the ACA represented a bargain. And the bargain was it extended benefits of group plans to individual insurance market, hopefully to create larger pools of patients to increase the predictability of expenses. And it provided subsidies to encourage more people to obtain health insurance, because a lot of people won't unless there are subsidies. And the goal was to alter the mix within the pools, create healthier pools to amortize the cost of adding people with pre-existing conditions to the mix. And then in the last two of my slides, I'm going to talk about some of what the benefits are of creating larger pools and then bringing younger and healthier people in. So this slide is a result of a thought experiment. We were analyzing data, federal survey data, on the cost of medical care. And what we did is we took 100 samples of different sample sizes to look at the estimate of the healthcare costs. And you can see that all of the annual healthcare cost estimates are about $5,000. But when you get larger samples, 100 samples of 10,000 respondents to these surveys, there is very little uncertainty around the estimate of $5,000. So this thought experiment just shows you the value of enlarging the pool of people who are sharing expenses. For those of you who have taken statistics one, you can see that in the very small samples, there are a lot of outliers that go all the way out, and that's just the rule of small and large numbers. You have much greater certainty when you have larger pools of people over whom you're estimating the costs. So in my last slide, I tried to show the benefit of altering the mix within the pools by looking at annual expenditures by age for three samples of people. In the blue sample, you can see that if you bring the so-called young invincible population into the pool, they have average costs of $2,000. In the more traditional mix of people who have health insurance prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, that was people who were 35 to 64, and the average costs were more than twice as great, close to $4,500 a year. So when you combine the two pools on the left, you average it out, you can see that you lower the costs compared to the red bar by over, close to $2,000. So that's the benefit of bringing the young invincibles into the healthcare pool. It lowers the average cost of the pool and makes it. So it's a combination of the last slide, which showed you the benefit of making larger pools, and this one, the benefit of bringing younger people into the system. That's why we have the Affordable Care Act. And without further ado, I pass the baton on to Dr. Kaufman.
Hi, thank you, Ed. We're just going to cue up my slides for a second here. I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. My job in about 20 minutes or so is to try to give you an overview of the whole Affordable Care Act. And because it is so vast and complex, that this is really a 35,000-foot overview. So my apologies if I'm glossing over things, but the idea is for this to kind of be the primer to set you up for the other talks tonight and then for the other sessions. So Ed talked about, you know, the good, very good reasons why we have the Affordable Care Act from the logic of insurance. The other reason we have the Affordable Care Act is up here in this dark red slice of this pie. And this is a pie graph with data on the health insurance status of Americans. 16% of Americans were uninsured in 2011. Similar numbers in 2009 when the deliberations on the Affordable Care Act began. So we have more folks who are uninsured, a higher proportion than any industrialized developed country in the world. It's a mixed group of people, varying characteristics, and we're going to talk about the ways in which the ACA helps some of those groups and doesn't help some of those groups. Before we get into more details, just want to point out that the ACA, like all pieces of legislation, is really a product of three branches of government, introduced and passed by Congress, signed into law by the President, and interpreted by the Supreme Court. And as we'll see in a few minutes, in this case, the Supreme Court interpretation very important for the final rollout of the law. Now, this is not an eye test. But it is complicated because the ACA is complicated. However, I think you really can break it, the ACA, all of the provisions into the ACA, or at least 99% of them, into two broad buckets. Over here are provisions that have to do with insurance reform, with improving access to health insurance for people. And then over here on the right, we have health systems reform, provisions that are about reforming the health care system. And why do both? Well, improving access to insurance is great. Having the help that insurance gives you with paying for healthcare costs, tremendously important. But if we're going to have a sustainable system where we can afford to provide coverage to most people in the country and to do not only give them coverage, but improve their health, So it's not just about taking care of you when you get sick, but trying to keep you as healthy as you can be, we need to change the delivery system as well as insurance. So that's the logic for having the two halves of the ACA. We'll turn to insurance reform first. A key part of the Affordable Care Act is the individual mandate, as Dr. Altman mentioned 2 weeks ago. And so the individual mandate is a requirement that all citizens and legal immigrants must have coverage or pay a tax penalty. So it's a sort of pay or play. Buy health insurance or pay a penalty. In 2014, the penalty is the higher of $95 per adult or 1% of household income, and it will rise over time. So the idea is even if you have a choice, everyone may think there is a choice, but there is a consequence if you choose not to have health insurance. There are, however, some important exceptions and exemptions. First, undocumented persons are exempt from the individual mandate because none of the provisions in the individual mandate that expand access to health insurance are available to undocumented immigrants. They're not eligible for the expansion of Medicaid or the health insurance exchanges. There's also exemptions for people to be temporarily without insurance for less than 6 months. Say you're transitioning from job to job or from school to job. Also some provisions that deal with financial hardship and religious objections. So some exemptions, but by and large, citizens and legal immigrants expected to either buy health insurance or pay a fine. I'm going to talk about Medicaid expansion. And for those of you who may not be familiar, Medicaid was established back in 1965, right about the same time as Medicare. It's a joint federal-state program that provides coverage to low-income people. We call it Medi-Cal in California, and you just heard me slip up and say Medi-Cal when I meant Medicaid, so forgive me if I'm going back and forth here. Historically, say Medi-Cal's been a is a program for low-income people. The eligibility has varied from state to state, and it's generally excluded low-income adults without children. In fact, really, Medicaid has been this program where it's kind of like, well, what category, what bucket does a person fit into? Are you poor and disabled? Are you poor and elderly? Are you poor and a single mom with kids? Are you poor and pregnant? If you fit into one of those groups, we might be able to cover you, depending on your income. But if you don't fit in those groups, sorry, out of luck. Maybe your state or your county has some other program, but not Medicaid. So what's really, I think, one of the most dramatic changes that the ACA has wrought is saying, well, you know what, for Medicaid anymore, the only thing that matters is are you poor or are you not poor? If you're poor, based on the ACA's definition of poor, you're eligible. And the ACA defines poor as 138% of this thing called FPL, federal poverty level. And that is about $32,500 for a family of four, about $16,000 for a single person. The level rises depending on the number of folks in the family. Now, the reason I mention the Supreme Court as being important here is that the ACA, as originally written, wielded kind of this Teddy Roosevelt-style big stick and said to the states, you either expand your Medicaid program or else we're going to yank out a lot of the federal money that supports your program. And the Supreme Court says, now, that's a fact. You can't wield that big stick. You can pull out some little carrots and dangle them, but you cannot put that much pressure on the states to expand Medicaid. And so as a consequence, some states, like California, have chosen to expand. Some have not. So health and insurance exchanges, which I think probably have gotten a little more attention in the media than the Medicaid expansion, these are available to individuals, families, small businesses. Again, in keeping with our great tradition of federalism, states have been able to choose whether to establish their own exchange. We did in California. It's called Covered California. You may have seen the commercials. Or to participate in a federal exchange. And again, here, the states have been really divided in which direction they've gone. I apologize that this slide, we did not get the color scheme right. But anyway, what is a health insurance exchange? Well, it's an insurance marketplace. They were envisioned as an online marketplace. That is, Peter Lee from Covered California says that you could sit in your computer and buy health insurance as easily as you could order a book on Amazon. Well, it hasn't been quite that easy. But that's been the vision, and I would submit that actually in California it's working a lot better than some other places. And the idea of the exchange is to enable folks to compare plans on quality and cost. And that's done in two ways, by having the same essential benefits and by having four standardized benefit designs. And so essential health benefits, this is the list of health insurance benefits that all health insurance plans in the exchange and beyond the exchange are required to cover. And it, you know, it's a pretty comprehensive list. Some of these are things that in the individual insurance market historically have not been that well covered. They're pretty typical things you would find in an employer-sponsored plan for the most part, but some things not so common in the individual market. For example, maternity and newborn care. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, there are a lot of policies sold in California in the individual market that didn't cover maternity and newborn care. There's been a real price premium if you were someone who wanted coverage for maternal and newborn care. Rehabilitative, habilitative services, mental health, substance abuse, things that either weren't covered or were not always covered very comprehensively. One thing to note at the bottom, essential health benefits include pediatric vision and dental, but not adult. And I think the lack of adult dental is certainly a concern because there are a lot of low to middle income folks who have a lot of dental health problems. Moving on to the standardized benefit design, you may have heard about the metal tiers, the bronze plans, the silver plans, the gold, the platinum. Well, what is that about? Well, what it's really about, as this slide tries to illustrate, is that it's about what fraction of typical expenses are paid by the health plan and what fraction are paid by the consumer when they get care, meaning the cost that you pay, say, when you go to visit the doctor or when you get a prescription or a lab test. And so over on the left here in the bronze design, in this kind of plan, the health plan pays 60% of the typical costs, and the consumer pays 40%. And if we go over to the right to the platinum plan, the plan pays 90%, and the consumer pays 10%. And so this is really a trade-off between premiums, because the 60, whether the part in blue that the plan pays, the plan pays for that through the premiums that consumers pay every month. And so it's really a trade-off here between a plan like a bronze plan where with only coverage for only 60% of typical expenses, that's a relatively low premium, say, compared to the platinum plan. But look up here at the gold bars and you'll see that in a bronze plan, the consumer, when he or she goes to the doctor, gets a prescription, gets a test, is paying a lot higher proportion of the cost than he or she would in a platinum plan. This is not necessarily a right answer, But this is a way of having four kind of standardized levels to help people make more thoughtful decisions about what seems right for them. Some people are going to say, I really like things to be predictable, and I want to have a platinum plan and have most of my costs come out of my premium. Other folks say, well, I think I'm pretty healthy. I don't think my expenses are going to be typical, so I think I'm going to go for the low premium plan and pay more out of pocket when I do need to get care. And again, there's no right or wrong, but what this does is really standardize it and make it easier for people to make apples-to-apples comparisons between plans. The exchanges also provide subsidies for persons and families with incomes between 133% and 400% of poverty. And you'll notice that bumps up the lower limit here for these subsidies in the exchange, bumps up against the upper income limit for Medicaid. And that was by design. As originally envisioned, in every state you'd have Medicaid covering up to about 133%, 138% of poverty, and then the subsidies in the exchange kicking in for folks up to 400% of poverty. That is the way it's working in California. That's not the way it's working in the states that chose not to expand Medicaid. And so how do these subsidies work? Well, there's really two types of subsidies. One is a premium tax credit. So that's a tax credit to help you pay for your monthly premiums. And that's tiered as your income rises. And then secondly, for folks between 133% and 250% of poverty, there's what's called a cost-sharing tax credit, and that's to help you with deductibles, copays, the things you pay when you get care. And the thinking there is that for folks who are in this 133% to 250 band, that if they were folks who, say, had a chronic illness and needed to get a lot of care, that they were going to need some help covering the cost of drugs, doctor visits, hospitalizations, in addition to the premiums. I'm going to talk briefly about the rest of the insurance slides because I want to move us to delivery system reform. So employer responsibility. The ACA does not have an employer mandate per se, but like the individual mandate, it says that employers with more than 50 employees, so there's an exemption for small employers, but for employers with more than 50 employees working 30 or more hours a week, you're going to pay a penalty if you don't at least offer something, that a plan that covers at least 60% of typical expenses. In other words, if you don't have something that looks like a bronze plan for your employees, you're going to face a penalty. This has been delayed for firms with more than 100 employees to 2015 and to 2016 for firms 50 to 99. And I think it's just fair to say that that's been a little controversial, and we'll leave it at that. There's also some incentives for small employers, those with 25 or less employees, if they meet certain conditions. It's really those small employers with workers with relatively low wages to give them an incentive to provide coverage. One provision I think that's been quite popular is a provision that permits young adults to remain on their parents' health insurance policies until age 26. This was implemented in 2010. Again, not for everyone. You've got to be in this age group and have a parent with health insurance. But if you are lucky enough to be in that age group, it's an alternative to Medicaid or the health insurance exchanges. I want to talk some now about individual insurance market rules. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, in the individual market, things really worked quite differently than in the group market. And when I say the group market, I mean coverage that's provided by employers or other groups. I mean, sometimes it's something like a professional association, but it's groups of people as opposed to single people or individual families. And in the individual market, there was a lot of what we call medical underwriting. And what that means is that there was a lot of your proportion of your health insurance premium that was really based on how healthy you were or how sick you were. And if you were someone who was unfortunate enough to have a chronic illness, unfortunate enough to have had cancer, you might not get coverage at all, and you certainly would pay substantially more for your coverage. If you were just simply older, you could pay substantially more. And so what the ACA says is, no, we're going to move away from that medical underwriting. We want to have this kind of equity in the individual market that we have in the group market. not perfect equity, but more balance. And so one of the things is guaranteed issue. If you apply for health insurance coverage, whether it's through the exchange or for an individual policy outside the exchange, you can't be denied. You also cannot be denied coverage for pre-existing conditions. So they can't offer you a policy that says, well, we'll cover you for everything except that breast cancer if it comes back, or except that lupus. You also can't have your coverage canceled without proving fraud. Premiums are really to be based on only three things: location. If you live in a place where healthcare costs more, you're going to pay more. By age, but age in only three bands, so much less heavy, you know, there's sort of a compressing, if you will, of the difference between what the young invincibles are charged and folks in, say, their 50s, early 60s are charged. ACA allows you to rate on tobacco use. We in California have chosen not to do that. But really, you know, to really have more equity, one thing that's explicitly forbidden to use is gender. And again, in California, gender, and in other states, gender was often used as a factor, and women were often paying more. For the whole insurance market, prohibitions on lifetime limits on coverage, annual limits on coverage, designed again to help folks with high expenses. Also prohibitions on cost sharing for recommended preventive services. Dr. Salganikoff is going to talk about some of the preventive services for women, so we'll skip over that. I think someone last week brought up medical loss ratios. Just very briefly, the point of these provisions is to nudge health plans to devote the bulk of their premium dollars, the bulk of their revenue, to clinical care and quality improvement, and if they don't do that, to provide rebates to consumers. So we'll now shift quickly to delivery system reform. I'm going to first talk about reimbursement of providers, because reimbursement, money, whether we like it or not, money is a big driver of behavior. And this is really important with the Medicaid expansion, because there's been a lot of concern about access to primary care. And, well, what do I mean by access? Well, what I mean there is your ability to get primary care. There's the ability to get an appointment with a primary care provider within a reasonable length of time. And again, the idea is it's not enough to just have an insurance card. If we really, truly want to improve health and have a more cost-conscious system, we need to enable people to get in to see primary care providers when they need to see them. This is a particular concern in Medicaid because only 66% of primary care physicians nationwide accepted new Medicaid patients in 2011, and Medicaid historically has paid lower rates than Medicare and private insurance, about 66% of Medicare fees on average. So what the Affordable Care Act has done is to increase Medicaid fee-for-service reimbursement for primary care physicians to Medicare rates. And the federal government has given states 100% federal matching funds. So that means it doesn't cost the state a dime or a nickel. It's all federal money to raise the Medicaid rates to Medicare rates, which are a lot closer to the cost of actually providing services. I think the big limitation here is this is only authorized for 2013 and 2014, and as of today, it's not at all clear whether the federal government is going to continue the 100% match, or if it doesn't, whether states will choose to reach into their own pockets to maintain the fee increase. Also, some changes in Medicare reimbursement for primary care providers and general surgeons. Something I think that those of you that are in healthcare may have heard about is efforts to use Medicare payments as a vehicle for stimulating improvement in quality of care in hospitals. So Medicare has reduced the payments, really, actually in this case not reduced, but refusing to pay hospitals for readmissions within 30 days, also reducing Medicare and Medicaid payments for hospital-acquired conditions. That would be something like MRSA and some of these nasty hospital-acquired infections people pick up. Also some funds for health workforce development. Reimbursement, very good for incentivizing the providers who are on the ground now, but you also want to think about training the next generation of providers. And so there are some provisions of the ACA that do that. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on delivery system reform. I think bundled payment and accountable care organizations were two terms that got bandied about in previous weeks, and we'll try to say a little bit about these. So what is bundled payment? It's an alternative to fee-for-service and capitation. Well, what are fee-for-service and capitation? Well, fee-for-service, as the name implies, is that providers getting paid a separate fee for every service that they provide. So every office visit, separate payment. Every lab test, separate payment. Every prescription drug, separate payment. Capitation is over at the other extreme. And the term capitation is derived from per capita, or per head, per person. And so under capitation, it's a fixed amount of money that the provider gets per year, per month, to provide all of the care that the person needs. Those are the two extremes. Bundled payment is in the middle, and it piggybacks, I would say, off the way Medicare has paid hospitals since the early 1990s. So since the early 1990s, when a Medicare beneficiary goes to the hospital, they're assigned something called a diagnostics-related group, a DRG, and that DRG, based on that DRG, the hospital gets a fixed sum of money to provide hospital services to that person while they're in the hospital. Doesn't cover the physician, but it covers the hospital bed, the nurses, any labs and things that are done in the hospital. What bundled payment says is, okay, well, let's drag that out a bit. Let's make that payment, if you will, drag it out, make it bigger, cover a bigger bundle. Let's go from 3 days pre-hospitalization to 30 days post-discharge, and let's include the major expenses that are going to be incurred. Let's go beyond inpatient care to hospital outpatient physician services and post-acute, and pay that all as a bundle to incentivize providers to provide the best quality care in the most cost-effective setting. Health homes are really within primary care and focused on having a primary care provider really be responsible for coordinating the care to ensure that all of the needs of people with chronic illnesses are met. So this might be an individual physician, might be a primary care group, might be a clinic. But the idea is everything from primary care, acute, behavioral, long-term care services. Again, focused on chronic illness. People who have high needs, some of them multiple chronic conditions. And the federal government is giving states 90% match, so 90 cents on the dollar, to do this. And states have a lot of flexibility designing these kinds of programs. But again, the real idea is how to coordinate care for those who have the biggest needs. Accountable care organizations are groups of doctors, hospitals, and other healthcare providers who come together voluntarily to give coordinated care. The goal is to give coordinated, high-quality care, and Medicare has special payment rates and incentives for this. You can kind of think of an ACO as a virtual Kaiser, if you will. That those of you know Kaiser Permanente, you go to Kaiser San Francisco, and most of everything you need is on the same campus, whether it's the pharmacy, the lab, the doctor's office. An ACO is like that, but maybe virtually connecting more independent providers. In terms of delivery system reform as well, I think as Dr. Luft mentioned last week, the ACA establishes some new entities to assess the impact of innovations in care delivery, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, or PCORI, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. I'm intentionally skating over public health and prevention, partly because I'm out of time, and partly because I think the ACA really is thin in this area relative to delivery system reform and insurance reform. We're just going to wrap this up, and some conclusions here. So the ACA is stimulating major reforms in health insurance and healthcare delivery. And I think it's fair to say that these reforms have potential to improve access to care and value, in other words, the health outcomes we're getting for a dollar spent on care. But I think important to recognize that there's substantial variation in implementation of the Affordable Care Act, largely because of the state discretion the discretion the states have about whether or not to do the Medicaid expansion, and the discretion they have about whether to do their own exchange and some of the rules within the exchange. And then lastly, with the demonstration projects and all that the Innovation Center and PCORI are doing, which are, it's great to have these demonstrations and tests of what works, but it does mean that you may have people in San Francisco who are part of a demonstration getting something quite different than people in LA or Fresno. to say nothing of other states. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Dr. Salganikov, who's going to help us dive deeper onto the impact of the ACA on women's health.
Great. Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I used to do most of my work in Medicaid, and I would always say, you know, the more you know about Medicaid, the more you know you don't know. And I feel that way now about the Affordable Care Act. The more you know about the Affordable Care Act, the more you know you don't know about so many provisions. And you know now, well, after hearing Janet, well, you had these legislators going thump with a big, fat, you know, 1,000 pages of legislation. What I want to do is kind of change the focus a little bit. I want to talk about the ACA, but I want to talk about what it means for women. The work at the I direct at the Kaiser Family Foundations, how I frame it and think about it is healthcare policy issues of importance to women. And so I've been looking at the ACA, really thinking about what, you know, how is it going to change care for women? So what I want to do is talk about why it's important to women and then how it's going to affect women, both in terms of access to insurance coverage and also some of the piggyback on some of the insurance reform that Janet spoke about. I'm not going to be able to talk about delivery system reform, but touch on that. And then what I want to do is talk a little bit about the contraceptive coverage issue that's coming up before the Supreme Court, and a little bit about some state choices around coverage of abortion services under the Affordable Care Act. So why was this, why women? Well, you know, when you think about and you think back to the run-up to the Affordable Care Act, so many women's groups were involved in part of that whole process. And not only were women's groups involved, but groups that were not traditionally women's groups, like AARP and the AMA, were also using the women's angles to really push healthcare reform. At the same time, you had groups like Concerned Women for America who were also pushing against, rallying women against health reform. But really, this was a really, really big issue for women during that whole process. Why is that? Well, there are lots of reasons. One of the basic issues is economics. This is a slide from the most recent Kaiser Foundation health tracking poll. We conduct this every month and have been doing this, I think, for at least the past 5 years, and goes back at least, I think, probably 15, 20 years. And this is a consistent pattern that we find, that women are more likely to report a wide range of barriers to care that are cost-related, everything from putting off postponing care, skipping tests, not filling prescriptions, cutting pills, having problems getting mental health care. And this pattern is notable in other data sources as well. Women also have a different relationship with the healthcare system than men because of their reproductive needs, starting with maternity care, pregnancy prevention. They have higher rates of chronic illness. They also manage care for their families, for their children, their spouses, and then very often are the caregivers for their parents or other disabled relatives. So they have a very good understanding. And if you look at some of the early enrollment numbers actually around the healthcare marketplace, you see that even though women have lower rates of having insurance, being uninsured, they have higher rates now of enrollment in the Affordable Care Act. So this really shows you the value that women have, women place on health coverage. And Janet talked a little bit about, we saw the pie on the share of the uninsured. This is the share, these numbers are slightly different than the numbers that she showed you, because this really looks at adult non-elderly women. These are women who are if you're over 65, you typically have Medicare coverage. About 1 in 5 women in the United States lacks insurance. The rate is slightly higher for men. And so you see 12% of those that population has Medicaid. As Janet said, a lot of people in the past, they didn't qualify for Medicaid, no matter how poor they became, because they didn't fit in the Medicaid buckets, the categories. And you can see here that this pie, this slice of the uninsured, kind of breaks out in a lot of different ways. About, if you look at the bottom, about 2.5 million women in the United States are undocumented. So these are women who are living here, not living here legally, but are women who are going to need health care services at some point. There's about 2.4 million women. We call those women, they're in the coverage gap. They live in states that haven't expanded Medicaid. So they are poor. Their income is all below 100% of the poverty level, but they are not going to qualify for subsidies on the exchange. That is only to get a subsidy, your income has to be above 100% of poverty. And if that sounds crazy, it's because it is. But that is the way it is structured. The law, when it was designed to be a puzzle that fits together. By taking out this Medicaid requirement, what happened is that basically there was a big hole in the puzzle. And unfortunately, those individuals fall in the gap. About 4.4 million women are going to be Medicaid eligible. That is, either they're eligible today and they're not enrolled, or because of the way the eligibility is set up, they're going to qualify for Medicaid. About 6.8 million, and that's a pretty large group, are going to be eligible for tax credits. Those are the subsidies that Janet spoke of. And about 2.6 million are women whose income is above 400% of poverty. So they're going to be eligible for access to insurance regardless of their health status, but they're not going to get any subsidies to get that insurance. If we look across the country, we can consider ourselves to be extremely fortunate to be living here in California, which is a state that has really tried and moved mountains to try to expand coverage. That hasn't been the case across the country. And about half the states are actually not expanding Medicaid. So these are some big states with very high uninsured. In Texas, 24%, one in four adults in Texas have no insurance. The poorest of the Texans in Florida, it's the same, Louisiana, all along the South. There's a lot of people there who are very poor who are not going to get coverage. I want to talk a little bit about the insurance reforms that Janet alluded to. And the first was that now there is a policy. You know, in the past it was, insurance was, this is something, when I start talking about this, my husband always says, you know, this really makes my eyes glaze over. So I'm just bracing, preparing you that this is really, it's really important stuff, because the details of how insurance operates really makes a difference in the policies. And a big part of this is how insurance is regulated. You know, a lot of the states like California was very progressive in terms of passing requirements, but that only affected a limited amount of insurance plans, and that's just the plans that are bought and sold in this state. The majority of workers are actually in self-funded plans, and that's when the employer is actually paying the full amount. They don't really have insurance in terms of the traditional sense of insurance. State policies didn't affect that. The ACA makes a lot of changes, and so there are now new rules that really affect not only the state plans, but also the larger self-funded plans. So we had no uniform national policy regarding dependent age coverage. In some states it was 19, in some states it was 21. This changed, and now nationally up to age 26, insurance is required. Now you can have, you have to have an offer of dependent coverage. And in fact, we saw a reduction from 2009 to 2012 of 5% in the rate of uninsurance among this young adult group. And this was the group that had the highest uninsurance rate. Similarly, around pre-existing conditions. In the past, insurance could say pregnancy, pre-existing condition. I know you need insurance and you're pregnant. We'll cover you, but not for pregnancy, or we won't offer you coverage at all. Similarly, women who were victims of domestic violence could be considered at risk, have a pre-existing condition, and been denied coverage. That doesn't exist anymore. There are no more pre-existing conditions. Individual insurance, we heard about gender ratings. Individual insurance plans could, and I'll tell you, many of them did, charge women higher rates than men. And that is after the fact that they didn't even include maternity coverage. So they charged women higher rates and without having maternity coverage. That now is banned. Gender rating is prohibited under the law. Similarly, maternity care, we heard about, was typically not covered by individual insurance plans. They would either sell you a rider, but you couldn't buy the rider if you were pregnant or there was a time delay before you actually got coverage. Now maternity coverage is included in all individual plans. Similarly, Preventive Services California had a large number of state requirements for the plans, as I said, bought and sold in the state for covering preventive services. Some states had very few. Now we have requirement that new plans, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what these new plans are, and as I said, these are includes all private plans. Not just people who are getting their new coverage through the exchange or uninsured, but all of us. If you're in either a self-insured plan, sometimes called an ERISA plan, or you're in an individual plan, or a smaller or large group plan, and that plan is not considered a grandfathered plan, that is, that plan has changed in some way, and the hope is over time the majority of individuals will be in plans that are required to cover this. And I think it's actually now the numbers are growing very quickly in terms of people in non-grandfathered plans. You will have coverage of a broad range of preventive services. This also applies to the plans that are sold on the exchange because those are all naturally, those are going to be new plans for those individuals. And what is that? And this is like the Janet slide. This is a lot of stuff here. And this is here so you can see the magnitude of preventive services that are now covered. And that is all the U.S. Preventive Services A and B, Task Force A and B recommendations, all the vaccines that are recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. As well, and for adults is an additional 8 services that were identified as preventive services for women that are covered by, they were identified by an IOM committee that found those to be gaps, and that includes the contraceptive coverage that you've heard so much about, but it also includes intimate partner violence screening, breastfeeding and lactation support services, breast pump rental, well women visits. So there's really, really a lot of important services. And we know through a large body of literature that financial barriers can be a limitation and a problem in terms of people getting preventive services. Especially when you have limited income, these always fall to the side. And so when you think about contraceptive coverage, and I'm going to just drill down a little bit around contraceptive coverage, what the law requires is all FDA-approved contraceptives as prescribed. And this gives you a sense of the broad range of services. Now, the insurance plans can use what they call reasonable medical management. Sounds like a good thing. To basically limit what is provided. And there is not a lot of clarity in the law in terms of how you get to some of the more expensive methods. And there have been some concerns, and actually in California they're introducing legislation here in the assembly. I think Holly Mitchell just introduced a law to basically require that the plans cover all of the different methods of contraception so that they can't use limitations, particularly some of the more expensive methods. There have been anecdotal reports that they're more difficult for women to obtain. Now, one of the issues that's really gotten a lot of attention is who's required to provide contraceptive coverage. So there are some exemptions. Not every single employer plan is going to cover contraception. Here, if you look at the red, these are the total exemptions. These are churches, synagogues, houses of worship. They are exempt, and their employees and their dependents are not entitled to contraceptive coverage. That's pretty straightforward and in the law. In terms of the requirements, then it's divided into for-profit and not-for-profit employers. All for-profit employers are required to include contraceptive coverage as part of the preventive services that they provide. The two Supreme Court cases that are going to be, the oral arguments are going to be heard in about a month, are for-profit employers. We're going to put that on the shelf for a second. And then you have nonprofit employers. And there's two categories there. There's the secular employee, the secular nonprofits that don't have any type of religious affiliation. Those employers are required to provide contraceptive coverage. If you are a religious affiliated employer, that is a Catholic or faith-based health system, a university, you object to contraceptives, then you can ask for an accommodation. And basically what that is you have to just sign a form certifying that you object, have a religious objection. And then what happens is either your insurance plan is required to cover this and absorb the cost, because the thinking is that actually keeping women from getting pregnant is actually going to save money. And there are actuarial analyses to actually demonstrate that. And, or if you're in one of these self-funded plans, then you can kind of, the third-party administrator is going to make sure that the women have the access to contraceptive coverage. And what they do is they kind of get reimbursed through a fee from the exchange. But basically, what's important to take away from this is that other than the women who work for faith-based, for a nonprofit house of worship, all of the women are supposed to get contraceptive coverage. And the goal here is to try to make an accommodation to religious groups, but at the same time making sure that women have access to this new benefit. The case in the Supreme Court involves two for-profit entities. One is Hobby Lobby, which is a national chain of craft stores, and the other is Conestoga Woods Specialties. These particular businesses object to not all methods of contraception. Hobby Lobby objects to emergency contraception, Ella and Plan B, which are morning after pills. And the Hahn family, who are Mennonites, they also object to the emergency contraception and IUDs. They believe that these emergency contraceptives are abortifacients, that they disrupt an existing pregnancy. The research actually shows that you cannot disrupt an established pregnancy, and that's how the FDA has ruled that these are contraceptives and not abortifacients, but their religious beliefs lead them down this path. So one of the fundamental question that the Supreme Court is going to be looking at does this violate their religious freedom? Does a business have the same religious rights as a person? And that's a really, really big question that I think is going to be get quite a bit of attention and has a lot of implications for also civil rights laws, because it really depends. You know, if you give the employer the same rights as businesses. So there are, I won't go through all of the different levels. I just don't have time. We do have a fabulous brief, and if you go to kff.org, feel free to check that out. And Lori Sobel, who is the author of that brief, is here as well. So I think that this is going to be a really, it's a really large issue that I think has much, much broader implications than the Affordable Care Act, insurance, or birth control, and I think will be a really important case. The other issue that I wanted to talk about is around access to abortion coverage. Abortion coverage was one of the kind of, at the very end of the Affordable Care Act, I don't know if you remember the debates around the Stupak Amendment, the Nelson Amendment. There were lots of discussions about whether, you know, what is the role of insurance in terms of covering abortions. Abortion is explicitly excluded from being included as an essential health benefit. So the states actually have a lot of latitude in terms of what can be covered. Under Medicaid, as many of you may know, Medicaid only pays for abortion if the pregnancy is the result of rape or incest or is a threat to the life of the mother. States can pay for abortion coverage under Medicaid with their own money, and 17 states do. California is one of those states. But in other states, unless you have a pregnancy and a result of one of these situations, you do not have coverage. In addition, now, 24 states have passed laws that say, you know what, no one on the health exchange can buy a plan that includes coverage for abortions. And the 9 of those states on top of that have said, you know what, not only just the exchange, if you cannot buy an insurance plan in this state that covers abortion. So in fact, what you have is you have the federal policy, but then you have the state policies which are directing that. And here you can see in blue, those are the states that don't have any limitations on abortion coverage. And the states that going to kind of the lighter shades and then going to the orange, and then those are orange are the states that also have the restrictions on the private insurance market as well. So kind of if you look at the share of women who are uninsured, about half of the women will be able to access a plan that includes abortion coverage either through their Medicaid program or through the plan that they purchase on the exchange or marketplace. But about a third of them will not have access to coverage for abortion. And so that is also cases if a woman has there's a fetal anomaly or she has a pregnancy which is not likely to survive or it could be a threat to her health and not her life, then she will not get coverage for abortion. There is a slice here of about 15%. These are the women who are in the coverage gap. Remember, we were talking about them earlier. Those are women who live in states that are not expanding Medicaid. Even if those states expanded Medicaid, 99% of those women live in states that are what considered they're the Hyde states. So they only offer abortion coverage in very, very limited circumstances to their Medicaid beneficiaries. So, you know, as we think about kind of what are the kind of the big issues for women's health, clearly enrollment is going to be a huge issue. It's everyone's top priority right now to try to get as many people enrolled, as many young, healthy people as Dr. Yellen was telling us about. But in general, to get the numbers up as much as possible. I think it's really also important that we recognize that the healthcare safety net is going to be critical. There are going to be a lot of people who are still not going to have access to coverage and people who are also going to walk away from coverage. At the end of the day, they are still going to need care, and we're still going to need to have a healthcare system that's robust enough to provide services for them. The other issue is around the preventive services, around the medical management, making sure that people are getting services that they're entitled to, training providers that these are services that now individuals are covered for, providing services in some cases that they haven't done around, for example, domestic violence screening and referral and counseling, which is an area that a lot of providers are not very comfortable with. And then around the reproductive health services, so focusing on contraceptive coverage, the big issue is going to be coming up is the Supreme Court arguments around Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods, and then also really keeping our eye on what's happening at the state level around abortion coverage and the Affordable Care Act. I think that's all I have time for right now, but I think we can entertain questions afterwards if anybody has any.
One of my patients, Lisa Sobjes, who's kindly agreed to be with us tonight to actually get the majority of the time here, because I really think that the patient perspective here is even more important than the provider perspective. I'm thrilled that Lisa has agreed to come and speak to you tonight. I've been taking care of her in one of our rheumatology clinics at our Parnassus campus for many years, and Lisa has been an incredible teacher in our clinics. She has not only taught our trainees and house staff that come through the rheumatology clinic about her complex chronic condition, but also I think been a wonderful teacher about health reform as it has unfolded just through her life experiences. And I think that's something that in medical education we don't spend often enough time on. And so I think we've been incredibly lucky in clinic to have Lisa share her experiences with us. So with no further ado, I'm going to hand the microphone over to Lisa and have her tell you about some of her experiences.
So, good evening, and thank you, Dr. Yastani, for inviting me to speak here. I'd like to tell you a bit about my experience with health insurance over the last few years. Up until I was able to enroll in the Covered California 2 months ago, I found it impossible to obtain affordable health insurance that would meet my needs. The main reason for that was that I was an English as a second language instructor in a higher education setting, and that higher education is increasingly only offering positions that are adjunct and don't have benefits with them. And they also tend to be low paid. Secondly, even though I abandoned teaching to look for employment in other fields, I still was able to find a position that offered comprehensive health insurance. And thirdly, I had an additional complication, which was I had a chronic condition, lupus, which made me uninsurable in the individual insurance market. So actually my unhappy experience with health insurance, or lack of it, began about 7 years ago when I graduated with my MA and lost my health care coverage that I've been getting through my university. I couldn't afford to pay for COBRA coverage, nor was I able to find a full-time position that offered benefits either in or out of my field. Since I couldn't afford to pay out of pocket for follow-up visits to my rheumatologist or lab work, I was no longer able to renew a prescription that I was taking prophylactically to reduce the chances of a lupus flare-up. About 8 months later, I did suffer a severe life-threatening lupus flare-up. I collapsed on the street. Someone, I don't know who, called an ambulance. I was hospitalized for a week, and I promptly received a bill for $54,000. Since I couldn't pay that bill, I was considered a charity care patient, and the charges were forgiven. The lupus flare-up, of course, necessitated a six-month treatment regimen, chemotherapy, but of course I couldn't pay for it, and so I wonder what I was going to do. Luckily, my rheumatologist, whom I hadn't seen since my insurance stopped when I graduated from grad school, got me enrolled in the lupus clinical trial at the National Institutes of Health. And so, luckily, I was treated there for 6 months, the chemotherapy, and I was successfully treated. I was lucky that I happened to be residing just a 45-minute subway ride away from NIH when I was living in D.C. I honestly don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been enrolled in that clinical trial at NIH. So, I was teaching English in D.C., I got laid off from my job, I suspect probably because of some residual effects that I had from my flare-up, and I moved to California. I moved 4 years ago. I was able to obtain high-quality health care coverage through the pre-existing condition insurance plan, but the premiums of more than $500 a month were killing me financially, frankly. I only had two part-time jobs, and so that's why it was difficult to afford. One of my employers in recent years did offer a health insurance plan for their part-time employees, and I looked into that. However, it was a junk insurance plan. It didn't cover any preventative care or prescriptions, and the deductibles were very high. I concluded that it was probably better for me that I forgo that insurance and continue basically going broke, paying for my pre-existing insurance plan premiums. That pre-existing insurance plan was high quality. It included preventative care and prescriptions and a lower deductible. In the meantime, I was wondering, though, how I was going to survive financially another dozen years until I reached Medicaid age. Medicare age, not Medicaid, sorry. I have to say, though, that one of the happiest days since my lupus flare-up occurred last December when I was able to enroll in Covered California, the California Healthcare Exchange. So what has that meant for me since I've gotten insurance through the California Exchange? Most of all, it's relieved a great deal of emotional stress for me. Why? Because I'm not under so much pressure to find a full-time position with benefits, as opposed to having two part-time positions, which is much more feasible given my older age. Tough to find a full-time job with benefits. I also no longer have to choose between being on a fast track towards bankruptcy, because now I have an affordable premium rate, albeit with the tax credits I get subsidized, or going without health insurance, which would mean foregoing preventative health care for my lupus or other conditions, and risking another life-altering medical incident. So I'm very grateful for the ACA and Cover California. Thank you for having me speak today. I appreciate sharing my experience.
Hi, I'm Erica Lawson. I'm a pediatric rheumatologist here at UCSF, and I'm thrilled also to introduce my patient, Christopher Tran, who is joining us tonight to talk a little bit about his experiences. I just briefly wanted to touch on the ways in which the changes of the Affordable Care Act have affected our patient population, and a few of them have been alluded to already tonight. So as a pediatric rheumatologist, I'm actually super lucky because we have a program in California called California Children's Services, or CCS, that's a comprehensive federally and state-funded program that provides really everything that we need to care for our patients under age 21 with chronic rheumatic diseases. It's really when they hit 21 that things get a lot more complicated, and the ACA has really relieved, well, not all of that stress, as Chris is going to explain to us, at least a part of it. And so previously, our patients were often in a situation when they turned 21. If they were full-time students, could, and their parents had private insurance, could sometimes remain on that insurance. But if they were too sick to attend school full-time or to be working full-time, they were often in a situation where they either had to go without insurance, which when you're sick is basically the worst possible time to do that, obviously, or they had to apply for disability at a very young age, which then would prevent them from working and prevent them from going on to realize their dreams. So it was a really, really difficult situation. Post-ACA, now all private plans are required to allow kids to stay on their parents' health insurance until 26. So if your parents have private insurance, you're in good shape. If your parents don't have private insurance, things can still be a little more complicated. But now with the health insurance exchanges and here in California, the Medi-Cal expansion, we're certainly in better shape than we were. So, Chris, do you want to talk to us a little bit just about your experiences in going through this transition?
Sure. I think sometime last year around this time, I was applying through San Francisco, I think, Healthy Families. And we went through all this paperwork process, filled everything out, and I didn't have to pay a dime to actually be in the program. Everything's covered, primary care and rheumatology, all that testing, fun stuff. So I think it was last year I actually filled out a Medi-Cal application because I'm not sure what plan my parents have exactly. And that's actually been the more annoying part. You know, it's the government. And I had to fill out a lot of, like, 10 pages more of paperwork, and I'm still waiting to hear back from them. So right now I still have San Francisco Healthy Families. At the same time, I think the ACA will start to phase out county plans, right? Or something like that.
Okay.
So I'm waiting to hear back from Medi-Cal, but at least I still have Healthy Families.
Yeah, and some of these plans are sort of shifting as the ACA comes into effect. But how do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about how your insurance situation affected you as you were going through this process of finishing your care in pediatric rheumatology and being cared for by pediatric doctors and having to go out and find an adult doctor and how that worked for you?
I mean, at first it was a little bit intimidating because I had no idea what to do coming from an immigrant family. But Dr. Lawson and Dr. Von Shaven helped me out a lot. And also Caroline Hill, the social worker, told me about Healthy San Francisco and how they would help me take care of all that, especially through the primary care provider. They set everything up for me to see the various specialists that comes with lupus.
And what do you think has been your greatest frustration in going through this process, or how do you wish it could be different?
Can't really say, because I'm still waiting to hear back from Medi-Cal, but... yeah, but, I mean, it's definitely a lot smoother than what I initially thought, since I have Healthy San Francisco and people actually guide me through it instead of just shooting blindly in the dark to go out and look.
Yeah, and so having Healthy San Francisco certainly is a fortunate thing that we have here if we live in the city.
Do most people know what Healthy San Francisco is?
No, okay, some people don't. Sounds like a lot of people do. But
I can't remember exactly how many years ago. It's been at least five. The city of San Francisco decided to sort of start its own universal health care insurance. And I work at San Francisco General Hospital, where we see a variety of people. And as long as they are residents of San Francisco, they're able to get relatively comprehensive care there. So medications, laboratories, imaging, access to primary care, and specialty care all provided on a sliding scale. And so I've actually found myself in a sort of ironic situation where sometimes my patients at the county might have better access to certain things, for example, expensive medications that are called biologics for some of the rheumatic diseases that we take care of, than some of my patients that have regular health insurance and have very high cost sharing. So I think it's been an enormously successful program from my patients' perspective, and the question is, you know, as people transition, especially the population that is eligible, you know, are they going to be able to actually obtain as comprehensive coverage when they transition to some of these plans, many of which have cost sharing included? So maybe we'll actually just open it up to the audience. I think Lisa and Chris would be happy to answer any questions, as would Erica and I.
And yes, all of us on the panel. So Dr. Salganikoff and I are going to come up. And so I know we've covered a lot of ground tonight. And, you know, whatever questions you have, please bring them up. Yes, in the red sweater. Okay, so the question is whether the ACA provides any incentives for healthy behaviors. I'm going to let Dr. Salganikoff take that one.
Kind of. There's a growing movement around kind of workplace wellness and a lot of kind of these incentive programs. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword, because if you reduce the premiums, if you provide an incentive for somebody who says, let's say you go to the gym or, you know, do kind of healthy living things, it's not that easy for everybody to do that. It's not that easy for working moms, for people who live in low-income communities, who don't have access to good foods or to gym facilities. So I think that, you know, while the intent is a noble and a good one, and I think as a society we need to do as much as we can to make sure that people can live healthy lives, I think that you really need to exercise caution in terms of doing financial incentives or benefits to people in terms of lower premiums because they're able or not able to do that type of activity.
Okay, yes? Okay, so the question is about how health insurance plans set premiums. And that's a complicated question, so we'll try to answer as best we can. I think, as I mentioned, one of the things the Affordable Care Act does is in the individual market really put some boundaries on what's used to factor into health insurance premiums. And, you know, for the most part, that's really the particularly the use of information about individuals has really been more in the individual market than in the group market. As Dr. Yellen showed in his slides, when you get into bigger and bigger groups, a lot of the variation washes out. So what the Affordable Care Act does that's important in the individual market is say that we're really only going to let premiums vary on three, and in some states, two factors. One is age. So you have three age groups, and younger people pay less than middle-aged or older folks. Second is location, and that's a recognition that the cost of providing care varies pretty substantially across the country. The third is tobacco use. That's maybe the one place where there's an incentive around healthy behavior. And as I mentioned, in California, we're not even using that one, I think, you know, for whatever reason. So to get to the rest of your question, so some of it's location, and, well, what causes that to vary across the country? Well, a lot of it has to do with competition. Some of that is competition among health insurers. Here in California, we've got kind of five big insurers. We've got Kaiser, Blue Shield, Blue Cross, Health Net, and United, and a few smaller ones, but there is a fair amount of competition here in California. You get to some states in the South and in the Midwest, and it's the Blues plan, and that's about it. So in those states, you don't have as much pressure from the health insurance companies on one another to compete for business. There's also variation in competition among healthcare providers. That in some markets you have, say, a lot of independent hospitals, a lot of independent doctors competing with one another. Some other places you've got kind of one healthcare, one system, you know, one hospital, one big group of doctors, and that's about it. So you may have heard in the news that there's a lot of outcry and grief in the resort areas in Colorado, because I think the Vail area is one of the most expensive in the country. Well, a lot of that has to do, part of it has to do with it's a resort area, and there's not as much, you know, it's a resort area, but most of it has to do with that is a place where there are very few providers, and they can command a premium. I mean, a premium is that they can command higher, they can command more from the health plans. And, you know, even here in California, there are some differences because here we have sort of three big, there's outside of Kaiser, we have two big hospital systems, Dignity and Sutter. And we actually pay substantially more than Southern California. And probably that has a lot to do with the having, you know, the hospital lack, relative lack of hospital competition. Right. I mean, no, I mean, so within, I mean, the ACA says in rating individual people, you can't use these things. When health plans go out and negotiate, I mean, a lot of this in terms of setting premiums has to do with the negotiations between the health plans and the purchasers of coverage, whether that's employers or health insurance exchanges, and then on the other side with the providers. And so where you have fewer insurers and fewer providers, there's less competition and thus less downward pressure. Yes. Okay, so the first question is, what are high-risk insurance pools, and are they? Do we still need them? Okay, so what high-risk pools really have been are insurance plans for high-risk people, meaning folks like Chris and Lisa and others with lupus and other serious chronic conditions, you know, the quote-unquote uninsurable folks, and to provide coverage for them. And I think, as Lisa mentioned, there are some good things about it, but the premiums have been high. When you have groups that are composed solely of high-risk people, premiums are going to be higher because all of them are more expensive people to cover. Those high-risk pools and plans are largely going away because the Affordable Care Act requirements for guaranteed issue. And again, folks like Lisa can now get a plan through Covered California, and they're no longer part of a high-risk group. They're part of a group with everybody, and so the costs are spread over more people and a mix of healthier and sicker people.
So no more.
No more.
Mm-hmm. I think it's not like an overnight.
Not an overnight. Phasing out.
You're phasing out.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so first a comment, appreciation for discussing coverage for women's health, particularly reproductive health, and then a question about whether the Affordable Care Act requires coverage for acupuncture. So the answer is basically no, with a little twist. So if you look at that, if you remember that list of essential health benefits that I showed you, acupuncture does not really fall, explicitly into any of those. Some states may have mandates on their books where the state says health insurance plans must cover acupuncture. Here in California, we have what's called a mandate to offer on employers. And what that means is that health insurance plans that sell to employers and other groups have to offer coverage for acupuncture. But the employer, the group doesn't have to buy it. And so it's usually kind of one of these rider things where, okay, here's your general plan, and oh, if you want to cover acupuncture too, here's how much extra it's going to cover you. The essential health benefits, the federal law has that list of 10 general services, and then each state has made its own decision about how to be more specific. So here in California, ours are pegged to the plan Kaiser offers in the small group market, and I believe that does not necessarily cover acupuncture. Some of the plans in Covered California may cover acupuncture, voluntarily, that they see that as a popular benefit that they want to offer, but it's not a requirement.
Can I just add to that I think that we're also now much more moving into a climate where insurers are looking for the evidence base. Yeah. And so I think that that's really where it's really going to be really important that the research, like the research that's conducted here, feed into that. Because if you don't have the evidence, you can't make the recommendation. I served on the IOM committee that made the recommendations for preventive services for women, and there were a lot of things that we thought, wow, that should be on there. But when you actually look for the evidence and you set the bar, and we all believe that we should practice medicine and healthcare based on evidence, unless that research is done, it's really it's going to be harder and harder, I think, to cross that bar and for insurers to pay for it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.